Hey, it's Kristen. I'm your host of Rational in Portland. Jesse Burke is in the studio. Jesse is running for Multnomah County Commissioner. Jesse's been on the show before. She, you know, everybody knows I'm not a journalist, but I'm happy to disclose that she is a friend of mine, and I think very highly of her. Jesse, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Sure, and thanks for having me.
Tell me why you decided to run for County Commissioner.
It's funny, I was thinking about the last time I was here, and that was nowhere on my mind.
That's so interesting.
I think the reason is, well, first, Sharon Myron asked me to, which is always nice to be asked.
Very nice.
But I think I was writing so much policy and being asked to solve so many, just come up with so many suggestions between the city and the county. And I was begging people to do any of them.
Who was asking you to write all this?
You know, when I did that initial 90-day reset for Old Town, that was at the request of the mayor's office.
You talked about that on the last episode, yeah.
Yeah, and then I was asked to do it with Central East Side, and then I was asked to do it with St. John's. And to be asked, you know, what are your suggestions for whatever policy of the day? And it felt like it didn't always matter how much input I gave. Like, I'm giving infinite hours, like 90% of my week. But it wouldn't always pass, which was really frustrating. And I think I've told you, I don't let elected officials in the building. I make them, if they want to meet with me, we sit outside. And I have them sit out front the hotel.
Why is that?
Because I know that most of them don't know what's going on. And, you know, I sat with Mike Schmidt outside. I sat with Rob Nose and Lisa Reynolds. And they're shocked. They're shocked at what's happening. I was asked by one of them if I set this up. And I was like, how would I do that? Hire a bunch of drug dealers and addicts? and you know, when I met with Mike Schmidt, there was a naked woman dancing right next to him the entire time. And I just sat and drank my coffee and I said, tell me how I can tangibly help you help me with this. And I tell them, you know, we're going to sit outside because it's really nice inside, I promise. And the doors are locked, but I want you to see what everyone is dealing with every day. And I said, I don't think you're a celebrity. I think you're a public servant and I want you to see how you're doing. And 100% of the time, they don't know. And It's so upsetting to experience that eventually I was like, I think I have to just get in the game as like one person that knows what's going on the ground. That, you know, I tell people I have picture windows into human suffering all day long. I've found dead bodies in my rooms, people that thought that they could handle the drugs outside. And I had someone recently ask me if we would be willing to, they're writing a grant for federal money for Narcan, and would we be willing to be one of their non-traditional partners?
You own the Society Hotel in Old Town. Yeah.
So would we at the Society Hotel be willing to be one of their non-traditional partners? And I said, what does that mean? And they said, your staff would be trained to administer Narcan. And I said, look, my staff are being traumatized all day, every day. I cannot add to that they are also responsible to save everyone's life outside. So these are kids. They're barely getting by every day. I just lost someone because there was an overdose and the person didn't make it. Someone sent me a video of the overdose happening while I was in New York, and then they panned to the right and all my staff were standing outside crying. And so I see how removed leaders are, and it's why I make everyone meet me in Old Town. And I was like, I don't know that everyone knows what's going on. I don't know that everyone knows how much everyone's suffering. And if you never come to the central city or you don't really have it in your neighborhood, you're never going to know. I mean, you get it right now with the library reopening.
Oh, it's more dangerous than it's ever been now.
Yeah. And what you have right now is what has been happening the whole time in Old Town.
That's right.
Right? And it's interesting. I always park over in front of areas where there are a lot of people using, because I know that the meter mates won't go over there.
That's interesting. I'm sure they won't.
I know that sounds bad, but...
No, I'm sure they won't. And some blocks, you can't avoid it. Mm-hmm. Especially, particularly around here. I parked right up against a tent. And, you know, two people who, as I was... were smoking fentanyl, as I was getting out of the car, commented on my appearance. I did not hide the disgust on my face. And they said, it's not like we're going to rape you. And this is my, you know, this is typical. This mm-hmm. is the morning into work. So, yeah, no, I get it. I guess the question, well, first, when you asked the current DA, Mike Schmidt, when there's a naked woman dancing right next to him, and you say, how can you help me with this? Mm-hmm. Did he have an answer?
This was before Nathan Vasquez had announced he was running. So Nathan was with him.
Okay, they were together.
Mm-hmm, and Mike said, we are trying to get neighborhood district attorneys back. And then he turned it over to Nathan to explain what that meant.
And that was Nathan's idea, yeah. The neighborhood district attorneys.
Correct.
Yeah, that's my understanding, too. When you bring these officials to Old Town and they see what's going on, of course they're shocked. This is the first time they've really seen what's going on in Portland. Which is bizarre, because that's who they ostensibly represent, is people like you and me who are dealing with this constantly, mostly you dealing with this constantly far longer than anybody else. People in Old Town, that is. What is anybody coming up with ideas after they see this?
I can't say that I've ever left one of those meetings feeling like they were going to handle it. Or that there was some tangible solution that, like, in one of my meetings with state legislators, I was asking about how do we get more detox and rehab facilities and making it easier to access. I said, I think that the city is ready to make the permitting process easier, and I think we need locum doctors and nurses, which are like traveling doctors and nurses, because we just don't have enough people here. Could the state help fund that? And they said, yeah, if you can find the facilities, we can see if we can get the money. And I was like,
how would you find a detox or rehab facility in Portland? Do they mean the physical space?
Yeah. I feel like I left that meeting like, Jesse, if you find us locations and get the permitting approved and find the doctors and nurses, then we can figure this out.
You're a hotel. Just to be clear, at this point, I mean, you're just running for something, but also at this point, you're a hotel owner. You're not a commissioner. You're not an elected official. You don't have some side gig job that involves policy making for any sort of leader in the city. Correct. Right? I mean, they're just saying...
But I mean, it's to the point of why am I doing this? I'm like, well, currently, apparently, I'm the call. And, I mean, on the Think Out Loud
debate...
You
might as well get paid for it.
Right. I mean, and have a vote.
Yeah, right? That's like, right. Have a say.
So on the Think Out Loud debate that happened last Friday, I don't know when this podcast airs, so I don't know how to say... I don't remember what last Friday's date was, but it was a debate between the District 2 candidates.
So that would have been April 5th.
Okay. The last question we were asked was... how are we different from each other? Because I think we weren't like fighting. And, you know, one of my opponents was like, you know, I'm a social worker. This is the work I've always done. Another opponent was like, oh, I've worked in politics for a long time. And I said, you know, I have a unique background. I was a social worker too. I was a teacher. I have a master's in public administration and strategic planning. And I work private sector, and private sector doesn't have the luxury of failing over and over with no deliverables, because we'd go out of business. And I said, and currently, our leadership calls me. I said, you know those 80 asylum seekers? Have you read about this?
Yeah.
The 80 asylum seekers, and they were going to lose their housing or their hotel rooms. Commissioner Gonzalez paid for an additional week. They called me to ask if I could help find where they could go. And I rallied everyone in Old Town that I knew could help me with this work. And we found where they will go. And I said this on the radio that I was like, we already work with everyone. It would be helpful if we could just get in there and actually solve some of these problems longer term, rather than just being sort of the ad hoc committee that, like, it's almost like it's not a real government. You know, like, we're just like piecemealing everything together. I'm like, you know, you could have like a normal system where like everyone talks to each other, and this isn't personal. This is a system that you're trying to make work consistently. But what it feels like, and I'm sure a lot of the public feels this way, is it feels like there are a lot of individuals who don't get along with a lot of other individuals. And so we're just going to let that play out rather than seeing ourselves as public servants that are here to serve the public and whatever it takes to serve the public. So that is why I got in this game, is that I have serious concerns about our process. And I have concerns about the lack of ideas or information that a lot of leaders are working with. And so it seemed like a good moment in time to try and help from the inside a little more.
And you obviously you've got, I know, because we've talked about it, you have great ideas and you have all the information, because not only do people, I mean, not all of it, but hopefully you'll have access to be able to get what you need if you get elected. And that's my hope for all of us, is that you get elected and you get in there and you ferret out this stuff and get some transparency going on. Because I know we're all concerned with that, and I know you're concerned with that too. But to the extent anybody has access, it seems like you have, I don't know, as much as anybody curious who's an elected official, which, you know, they don't have a ton, but it seems like you're right where they are. They're coming to you for information. What kinds of changes are you going to make if you're elected?
The one that I talk about the most, and it's born out of two things. One is, you've probably heard of the Martin versus Boise Ninth Circuit case, where you can't move anyone that's sleeping on the sidewalk or arrest anyone. And I'm not suggesting it's necessary to be arrestable, but you can't move anyone unless you have somewhere for them to go. And I asked, like, 4 or 5 years ago, I was like, well, how would we ever know? We don't have like a central database. No one can see. You have to call every single shelter. And then I went through the process of trying to get someone a shelter bed. And I don't know if you've ever done that. Have you?
Yes, but up in Seattle area, not down here, and not recently. And I, from what I've heard, it's next to impossible. I mean, Andrea Suarez from We Heart Seattle has driven up and down the state trying to find one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the process is you call 311. This is assuming you have a phone. And then they'll email you a list of all the shelters, and you have to call every single shelter. And
so you need a phone, you need email, and you need access to those things right away. It's not like you can bop on over to the library in 2 hours and get it.
Right. And then after you call every single one, and most of them are reservation based. So, you know, I tell people, who's planning on being homeless? You know, you can't make a future date reservation. But, you know, otherwise, I guess you just suffer outside until that date comes. If you do find a spot, you then go to a central registration site in Old Town, and then they give you a bus ticket to get there. And I tell people, imagine you're not you. Imagine you're struggling mentally or you're addicted. That is too hard of a process. I tell people we have to make it easy for people to make the best decision for themselves. And it's too hard. So, you know, my feeling is the central database I'm talking about, I'm like, I can help you. It's hotel software. We all use it. It's like a couple $100 a month. And initially people were like, oh, but what about everyone's medical information? I said, do you think I have all my hotel guests' medical information? I just need to know your name and when you're coming. So I said, you know, you have that platform and it feeds an API into a central booking, like a booking.com. And you can see it. Where is their availability based on my parameters, right? So all the shelters.
Yeah, let's just get in compliance with the law first. Then we can worry about triaging and medical information.
Right. And, you know.
Get people off the streets and sheltered.
I asked some people at the joint office. I suggested this and they said, why is that important?
That's the joint office of homeless services between Multnomah County, which you're running for, and the city, which, according to Sharon Myron, this seems right. Really, is this your understanding? Really just gives the county a blank check. The city doesn't dictate.
They don't get to control any of the money.
Yeah.
Correct. But so it's not blank. Office. I think it's $40 million. But the joint office, I'm suggesting.
No, I'm sorry. By blank, I mean, here's, you know, money. Go pour it into a hole for all we care kind of a thing.
Yeah. but they said, why is a central database important? And I said, remember in the 80s before the internet, if you went somewhere and needed a hotel room, you had to call every single hotel. That's not efficient. I don't understand why this isn't obvious. So that's the one that I think is mission critical. The other is you have to drastically increase the number of walk-in shelters, because right now what we keep doing is we keep coming up with, you probably saw this 90-day emergency, which I was like, amazing. We're doing a 90-day fentanyl emergency 5 years late. Like,
right.
And there was virtually no action.
Right. So there was really no acknowledgement of an actual emergency.
Right. I mean,
nothing was done.
Emergencies mean there's going to be some sort of action and change.
In
and
this state, it means study. Meetings and studies.
Someone told me, Portland loves process.
We
don't care about outcomes. And I was like, I think people do care about outcomes. Just maybe we need more people to care about outcomes.
The constituents do. Yeah. The constituents do. We're just waiting. We're waiting for those.
Yeah.
And we just never get them.
Yeah. So when you have right now, what we did with this emergency was we're essentially like, we're going to house 50% of our current homeless population in the next 2 years. And I was like, if we're not planning for 110% of the current population in the next 12 months, we've already failed, right? Like, what business is like, I'm going to solve 50% of my problem that's in front of me? You don't do that. You make a plan to solve the whole problem plus any variables that maybe you didn't account for. So if we get enough walk-in shelter beds. And I think what we honestly need to do is we need some non-traditional partners here. For whatever reason, churches can be warming shelters, but they can't serve as walk-in shelters. And I need to get in the weeds more about why this is, but I think it's a use of funds. They can't have, like, for example, Blanchet House. Blanchet House has a Catholic affiliation. They get no public money. It's all fundraising. And it's one of the most successful programs in the whole region. So is there a way to, I mean, people want to help. And we're essentially icing people out, even though they want to help. So can we get more walk-in shelters? Everyone found the warming shelters. No matter their mental state, everyone found warming shelters. So I feel confident that people would find walk-in shelters if needed. And we talked a little bit about this before the show started. I do think, though, we need to address the near impossibility of staffing these unless we come up with parameters that don't put those that are staffing it at risk, right? So I understand the purpose and intent of low barrier and no barrier shelter. But if most people don't know what that means you can come and you can still be using, you can have weapons, you can have pets, And philosophically, I understand that's good for the person that's coming, meeting them where they're at. It's very high risk for the people working there. I had someone that worked for me that for many years worked at a low barrier shelter, and he was severely assaulted 3 times before he quit. And so we're never going to have success staffing unless we're talking about every shelter, a neighborhood, a city is like a healthy ecosystem, right? Every decision we make has to, we can't hurt one group at the benefit of another group. And that's across the board. So we cannot say this is good for the person coming, but it's going to be bad for whoever works there, because then no one will work there. So how do we flesh this out and make this workable for everybody?
What would you do?
You know, I do think that we, statistically, the most successful shelters are not low and no barrier. You have to have some standards,
right,
for people.
Like Bybee Lakes or,
yeah. Right. And I mean, you know, I talk a lot about the social contract that we all agree to as citizens of a society. And someone said the other day, wait, what's the social contract? And I said, it's the laws we all follow here. But the social contract is we all agree to be contributing members of society. And if you fall through the cracks, it's okay, we'll catch you. And it's not a perfect system, but we'll make sure that you have some form of health care, that you can, we'll help you find housing, you'll get meals if you need a bus pass. But the deal is that you keep trying to get back to being a contributing member of society. And if you can't, for whatever reason, maybe you're disabled beyond a certain point, that's okay. We'll find a care situation for you. But the deal is not, this is awesome, I'm just going to keep going. That's what people are getting disenfranchised with right now. That they feel like they're getting played. And that's what makes people feel disillusioned about policy. It makes them start having compassion fatigue. That, like, people are over it. And it's because I'm a firm believer in compassion first. Like, I lost a brother-in-law it wasn't fentanyl, it was a heroin overdose. A lot of my family members are addicts, but not everyone responds to incentives. Some people respond to consequences.
Addiction's a disease of denial, generally.
Yeah. And I mean, I sat on a panel with the Portland Business Journal. Most of the panelists were recovered addicts that were working as executive directors of different programs. Almost every single one said, jail saved my life, right? Which was surprising to me. I didn't expect that would be the answer. But like, a lot of people were like, and one of them said, because the mother of his children was a current addict. He's recovered. She's currently addicted. And he said, I wish she was in jail, because at least I'd know she was alive. And so I think that I say this as someone that's not from Portland. I've lived here for a long time. I've lived here 20 years. But being from the East Coast, that, like, they really worry about appearing judgmental here. But judgment is discernment, right? You can discern that this isn't right. Addiction cannot be normalized in this way, right? It needs to be treated as something that needs attention and care and treatment. And I say, I don't know how we got to fentanyl and meth being like the acceptable addiction, but like if you had a friend that was an alcoholic, you wouldn't be like, awesome, keep going. Should we drink together? No, you would say, how can I support you? Do you want me to not drink near you? What's best for you? And for some reason, the way we're treating addiction for these incredibly dangerous drugs is, it's okay, keep going. And I mean, people are actively killing themselves all day long. I mean, you've probably seen the stats of overdoses.
Of course. I mean, I walk past, sometimes they're dead. I realize that they're dead later when I watch them get scraped off the sidewalk, much like I'm sure you do. But I mean, I walk past people that could be dead every day. Yeah. If I stopped for every single one, I'd never make it anywhere. Yeah. I'd be late to, not just late. I mean, my kids would never see me.
I think that the thing that
it's so weird. Like you said, yeah. Normalized. Like I was thinking about this the other day and I'm like, how did I end up in a city where I'm in this position of walking past so many people that could be dead that I don't think about it anymore.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that is actually the most dangerous thing, that we have desensitized ourselves to suffering, that is sort of the first step to losing your humanity.
We couldn't right? get, I mean, I couldn't get up in the morning. You know, if I really sit and think about it, I don't know that I'd get up in the morning. I really don't. I mean, if I really sat with the reality of what's going on in this city, it'd be very difficult to function.
I mean, I hear you. I'm exactly the same way. I feel every morning like I'm going into a war zone and I have to mentally prepare myself. And when I leave, it doesn't matter where I go. Nowhere is like this. And
that's exactly right.
And that it's the relief that I feel and like the peace. Like I'm like in New York City and like no one would ever be like, oh, New York's so peaceful. But it was relatively. And, you know, I had an incident there that I was like, I think that Portlanders may be more hardened than New Yorkers right now. I took my kids. I have three kids and they're younger. They're 9, 12 and 16. And we were at a coffee shop and my husband had stepped outside and my youngest was sitting across from me and my other two were on the same side of the table with me. And this really intoxicated person came over and he was super aggressive and he was right next to my youngest and he was asking me to get him something for his birthday and I was like, anything you want, what would you like that I have here? But I find I always have this low grade simmer because I'm so upset about what has happened in Portland and where I work that I made it all of 15 seconds of negotiating with this person before I stood up and I went to the side and I said, I need you to get away from my children. And he got really angry and he's like, I don't give an F about your children. And he tried to punch me and I backed away. He'd missed. And my oldest yelled, she's like, hey, get away from her. And only then did anyone in the room do anything. I was totally unfazed. This person like picked up a chair and started swinging it around. And like my kids, myself, like everyone else, the staff, the other customers were totally frazzled. They're like, call the police. I can't believe this is happening. And I was like, this happens to me like two or three times a week.
Yeah, you're probably used to it.
I am used to it. And I was like, what a terrible feeling that like something that should be really upsetting. Even my little kids were not that fazed by it. And sure, people can be like, oh, that's good. Your kids are tough. I'm like, no, I would not like my kids to normalize this. No. I mean, my oldest and I were asked to come testify in Salem for TriMet because they're trying to, they passed it, but that they were there was a bill to try and make illicit use of illicit drugs on transit illegal.
Isn't that amazing that we had to do that?
I was like, you can't even have open containers on transit. I don't understand. But whatever. So we went and she testified and she said, you know, she shared two experiences. One was she was on the MAX and someone was high on meth and they tried to attack her and a teacher stepped in between them.
How old was she at this point?
She was 14. And then the next year when she was 15, someone started openly smoking fentanyl next to her on the MAX and they stopped the train and she was stuck there for 3 hours and the person that was smoking was trying to attack all of the people on the train. And she said at the end, we're children and we expect the adults in charge to protect us. And if you can't do that, why are you in charge? And it was silent in that committee room. And it passed 5-0 out of that committee. And they asked us to come back, that they were like, we need your daughter to keep talking because I don't think that. And, you know, to my point earlier about people not being in the weeds, they don't necessarily know. And to have a child come say this, I mean, I don't know that everyone knows how dire it is right now. that are making decisions. I think everyone else knows how dire it is, but I'm not sure all of our decision makers are like in the weeds. I said on the governor's task force, the city is all caught up with public sentiment. The city is actually in the weeds a lot. The county's about a year or two behind, and the state's 2 to 3 years behind. So I wait for you to catch up. So that's, I guess that's what I would do.
You're not on that task force anymore.
It's ended. So it started in August of 2023. We had 3 meetings, and then it ended with the big business summit. They send updates periodically still.
But. What was the, I'm trying to understand what the outcome of the task force was, or did you have a objective?
Well, I think that there.
I mean, what was the quote unquote task of the task force?
They had different committees. I think that part of, I don't even know where to begin with this. Part of the dilemma is, you know, I was one of 2 small business owners on this. The rest were elected officials or larger organizations, either large companies who are not like ground floor front facing or, you know, large institutions.
So more people who don't know what's going on mm-hmm. the ground, like more people you'd have to bring outside mm-hmm. if they met you at the Society Hotel to see what's going on.
Well, and like, I think you make decisions differently. I told Ted Wheeler once, if you ever don't know what to do, just call a small business owner. We don't have the luxury of not knowing.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Yeah, like, well,
as one, I can agree wholeheartedly with that.
Right, and you have to decide right now. And you don't have a lot of cash backing you, so you have
no
to
cash
make decisions.
Back. My cash backing me.
Right. Yes. Right. And so it's like there's no like waiting it out. So I think, you know, the intent was good. I see that people struggle to make decisions. Portland in particular is struggling to make big moves or bold moves that could actually move the needle. Even, you know, with this amazing opportunity where we really rallied hard with some other businesses in the neighborhood for this idea of bringing light manufacturing back to Old Town. And the state legislature was amazing. They were like the early adopters, and they committed in this cycle of budget $2 million to help us buy buildings and get manufacturing operations going and sort of build a fashion district. Which was amazing.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. And I was like,
you already have that sneaker store. Do you still have that? Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's some really good stuff that, I mean, apparel there.
Yeah. Well, and so I was like, oh my God, the state legislature is like going to lead. They know that we need something big and bold. And Prosper Portland started getting some pressure to participate, but they were, you know, really hesitant. And then the governor just wrote that she wants to line item veto it until someone else puts money in. And I was like, you guys, do you understand that when private sector isn't investing, public sector invests because your job is the greater good, and like to invest in the big thing, even if it's not an obvious investment. That is literally the purpose of government-funded economic development agencies or economic development. So just this fear of failure, this lack of, you know, willingness to do big ideas for fear of whatever the backlash is really, it's painful to navigate. Like, as much as, you know, I find it frustrating that all of these little solutions, like finding a solution for asylum seekers or, you know, all the projects we're doing in Old Town, we're managing like $2 million of capital projects as a neighborhood association.
Is that the Old Town Community Association?
Correct.
That you're president of that.
Right. So it's like all of these little misses, but then the big ones that it's like, we have to do this too. Like, we have to have every investor teed up. People want to invest because they saw the state legislature was willing to go first, but now they're wanting to back out because it's the chicken and the egg, right? And I'm like, could someone just make a move so that we can move forward? But we're going to be stuck in this purgatory until either a bunch of private outside money comes in, because there's not a lot of money in Portland.
No, or there's not.
Or the government gets a little more comfortable with risk and just makes some bigger, bolder moves. So that's, I don't remember what the question was, but.
Well, I mean, Jesse, here's a question. Why are you still here? Because most people listening to this, particularly small business owners, would think, forget it. You've got little kids, three. Mm-hmm. I only have two. You have three little kids. You're running the Society Hotel here. You're running the one at the Gorge. You're involved in your community to a degree that no one I've ever met certainly is or has ever been or probably ever will be in their life. And you're being asked to do more. I mean, most people would look around and go, I'm not doing this anymore. And your taxes are sky high. I mean, we're right up there with, as Anthony Effinger reported in Willamette Week, New Yorkers who make $25 million or more. My guess is that's mm-hmm. not your salary.
Correct. It's funny. So I think I've told you this before. So I was on the U.S. fencing team for 10 yeah. years.
And I love that story.
And I spent a lot of time in Germany because that was, there was a school there that we all would stay at while we would go to World Cups.
And you you were living fencing, were you not? As a minor, you mm-hmm. were like living away from your family and.
Yeah. So I moved to Rochester, New York when I was 12 to train at the women's training center there. So I was there 12 to 18 and then I went to Penn State. But anyway, so I spent a lot of time in Germany and a lot of time with Germans. And I recently had a German reporter come to the hotel to interview me. And he was like, what is going on here? And I was like, I have been waiting for a German to come interview me for so long. And he's like, because it's in Germany, everything is very logical and very linear. There's
so it's the opposite of Portland, Oregon.
No deviations. Yeah. Like, I remember I would like, anytime I said anything just to be fun or funny, all the Germans I was with would be like, that doesn't make sense. Stop. So anyway, he was like, why are you still here? And I was like, I mean, I care about this city. And also I own the real estate, right? Like I own the building in the Portland Hotel. I own the buildings in Bingen. And it would be hard to
yes,
leave.
But there was a time when you could have. I mean, right now, commercial vacancy rates are terrifying. But there was a time when you could have sold it, I bet, for a pretty good price.
Not in the time that Portland, like that old town, like not since 2020.
Right. No, I agree with that.
I mean, just before 2020, we had a really good building value. But I also I wouldn't have considered leaving then. Like there, everything was going fine. We still had homelessness issues and fentanyl wasn't really here yet. So like it was like not even on my radar.
It certainly hadn't exploded the way.
Right. So like 2020 was
I understand.
The pandemic, decriminalizing possession, electing Mike Schmidt, the Black Lives Matter protests.
Defunding
like,
the there police. Was, yeah.
Right. There's like this storm of things at once. So that sort of collapsed at least my industry and neighborhood. And so, you know, that's why.
What's going to be your agenda item? I know hotel software some mechanism to figure out where shelter beds are, how to get people into shelter beds, everything you just said. What's so interesting is you said this back when you were first on this show. I don't even remember when, but it was a long time ago. And, you know, Sharon Myron from the county, she was talking about this too. And I know she's not the chair and she's not the quote unquote decision maker because that's the way that Byzantine County system that you're running for works. But no one has implemented this. I just find it so bizarre that it's not like people don't know that the answer is hotel software. They do know. Everybody I've talked to, elected or not, that is involved in this arena says, oh yeah, Jesse says it's hotel software. Nobody's done it. Mm-hmm. What is wrong with this place? I mean, do you have some sort of theory about why can't we do things? It's weird. It is weird. Yeah.
I think, you know, I have a friend, one of my closest friends who said to do anything, you need to have the capability and the will. She said, we have the capability. So what's missing? And I do think it's the will. I think that in times like this, there are winners when things are falling apart. And, you know, I think that it's a bit of a rabbit hole to go down who is winning right now, but it's not the community at large. It's not winning.
Sort of like in The Big Short, or, you know, that movie about the right. financial collapse. It's
someone's always winning.
Somebody was getting rich off of that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, you know, I think that there are some of us that are running, that we're kind of running as a team, and we've been talking about what are the things that you can fix, like, day one. And one of the things that I learned recently, so while it's supposed to be that anyone can get anything on the agenda with 7 days notice, there was a new administrative rule, I don't know when it went in, but that the chair still dictates what gets on the agenda. So I think one of the first things, because you really just need a vote of three, is to change that administrative rule.
That would be great.
Right. So I think that there are a lot of things that are sort of like administrative tasks that could change a lot of things, right? So I think we need to change that administrative rule. I don't know if you know about the AMR situation with the ambulances.
Yeah, but educate us a little bit mm-hmm. about it, because there's a possibility that somebody is just now listening to this episode mm-hmm. and doesn't know.
Right. So AMR is our private sector ambulance contractor. So you'll see all of the ambulances have AMR on them. And so what the rule has been in the contract, and has been throughout at least this region and maybe the country, is that you need to have, I think it's 2 EMTs and 1 paramedic in every ambulance. So what's happening is there's no one in the pipeline going to school to become an EMT or a paramedic. And AMR and other ambulance companies can see this. You can see what the graduation rates are, what the number of students are coming through. And so we just don't have enough ambulances if we need those staffing levels. And so what other regions have done, what right now in Multnomah County, we're getting to 60% of the calls with ambulances. What surrounding counties did at the request of AMR, because they could not get the staffing that they needed, can we switch to 1 and 1, 1 EMT and 1 paramedic? The surrounding counties did that, and they now get to 90% of the calls. So when AMR went to Multnomah County, they requested, can we transition to 1 and 1? Not only did Multnomah County say no, they then fined them $500,000. And it's almost laughable to me, like the alternate reality that it seems we are living in, where I don't know what people expect this company to do, but they also don't have to stay, right? This is private sector. They don't have to be our contractor. So who's going to work for us? And what do we do if we just don't have ambulances?
Could AMR theoretically just jump ship at the end of the...
I believe so.
Period. And then it's possible that we could just be left flat-footed with no ambulance services?
Yeah. I mean, theoretically, I haven't read their contract, but theoretically, there's probably an early termination clause where you just buy your way out. And so it's just a fool's errand to approach problems like this. So one of the things the group of us were talking about was effective immediately. We have to change this AMR ratio. And then, you know, I was talking to my strategists, and they were like, how are you going to get county employees to do what you want if they, like, just want to work their job, you know, 9 to 5? And I said, I don't think I'm expecting anyone to do what I want. I think that I'm a firm believer everyone wants to do a good job at their job. And I think collectively everyone knows the answer. So I want to hear from them. What do they think should be happening? And I met with someone that works at the jails. And she said, did you know that we used to have a rehab-ready dorm block?
Yeah.
And it was really successful.
Nicole Buescher was in here talking about that. She's the head of the corrections union.
Yeah, yeah. That's who I was talking to.
She's incredibly informed.
Yeah. And so I think it's little things like that, that it's like, what a difference that could make. She's like, we always funded it, but it's just not sexy enough, I guess. And I'm like, okay, well, that seems like pretty low-hanging fruit. So let's just tee up some of these programs that are successful and maybe need more funding or have been successful, and for whatever reason we got rid of. We can study why we got rid of it, but I'd be hard-pressed to think that things are going awesome right now relatively.
My understanding is, from Nicole and from actually the chair currently and the previous chair, according to Nicole and according to the sheriff's office, is that they Multnomah, it's ideological. Multnomah County has just not liked the idea of doing anything within the confines of jail.
Yeah.
Anything at all.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what it is.
So your listeners know how funding for the jails work, you do it by dorm block, right? So it's not funding the jail or not funding it. It's, I think it's like 18 beds in a dorm block, right? So it's how many of those dorm blocks are you funding? I could be totally wrong with that number. But anyway.
But it's a block. It's not just the jail as a whole.
So what the ideology is if you don't fill all the beds, then crime is getting better.
Yeah, that's what Nicole said. Yes, and exactly.
Then you can fund it less.
And we know this isn't true. Right. Like, we have, what, 250 beds? Is that what she said, that are not being used and crime just continues to go up?
I think that the thing that needs to shift, I was like, just being private sector, I'm like, that is a ridiculous philosophy. That much like in a business, you have to anticipate some loss, right? Like, you budget in what your loss might be for linens or something like that. You should anticipate that you're always going to have a certain amount of crime. And then, you know, maybe it ebbs and flows from there. But like, this idea that we keep, that the goal
we'll just eliminate zero. Crime by eliminating the jail.
Right. Like, the idea that you're going to get to zero or close to zero, but like, we're improving in that way. I was like, I don't understand. That doesn't make any sense. Or even the maintenance of their facilities. Did she talk to you about the maintenance of their facilities?
Yeah, that's not funded either.
No. And I was like, well, how are we not carving out a percent of the budget for maintenance? Like,
I mean, we have a duty to these inmates. I mean, totally. The government does.
She said, do you know what they, I said, what happened with that flood that happened in the jail? Did they fix it? And she said, no, they got us galoshes.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't understand what you're even telling me right now. So it's...
And these are people who claim to love the criminal side of criminal justice. I just don't understand. I mean, if you are so interested in the well-being of criminals that you want to free them almost regardless of what the charge is... Look, if they're in there, I just don't understand how it ends once they get in. Like, once they get in, don't you also care about whether they're dry and not living in a mold infested? I mean, are we just punishing the sheriff's office? Like, what are we doing here?
Well, I mean, even the juvenile detention center, through that really cold snap, they lost heat for like a week. Anyway,
It's just unconscionable.
It is. And I
think it's unconstitutional. I mean, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but just sitting here, it's, it just sounds unconstitutional. It sounds like bad conditions.
Yes. And I think, you know, when people ask me why I would do this, more than anything, I'm like, I'm not sure that anyone has any, like, executive leadership experience. Like, I don't know that people know how make a plan with a budget and execute that plan. And that's what we're observing. So, you know, I think that I could assist in that department. I've told a lot of people my current profession is building and managing healthy teams and organizations. And it's a discipline. It's a real discipline to build a healthy culture and maintain that healthy culture and process and be disciplined about the consistency. You know, early on I had someone say to me that was managing our hotels that hospitality was just toxic. Like, that's what I should get comfortable with. And I said, I don't accept that. I think that's a choice. So you don't work here anymore, and I'm going to take it from here. And I did. I had to completely shift this culture, and it did require, like, a lot of people didn't get to stay. But because you can see when
people... It was uncomfortable.
Well, you can see when people are going to be bought into this shift or not. And you need, especially during something hard, like a culture shift or a transition or an ideological change, you need everyone rowing in the same direction. And if everyone is not rowing in the same direction, it's either way harder for everyone that is, because someone's rowing against you, or you're just spinning in circles. So it's mission critical that everyone is clear on the goal, is committed and bought in to what is going to shift. And, you know, I don't think most people would say things are going well right now. Whenever people say that they are, I invite them to come have coffee with me in Old Town. But
yeah. And those, I also have this theory. You travel all the time. You and I both know that the journalist Nancy Rommelman, she uses the word hermetic to describe Portland, and I think mm-hmm. it is dead on. I think most people, for whatever reason, in this city don't travel. They don't like to, mm-hmm. or they just don't. I don't really, maybe it's because we just don't have any money. That could be part of it. But, you know, the air, as you know, since you travel, you can't fly anywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, just try to get to Houston on a weekend. Try to get there. Mm-hmm. It's one of the biggest cities in the United States. Dallas. These are all very difficult to get to directly from Portland. It's wild. I've never seen anything. I've never seen a populace so insulated mm-hmm. from the rest of the country, let alone the rest of the world. And so it's just easy to keep repeating. Everything's like this. Mm-hmm. Everything's like this.
That's right. Yeah.
There's no personal knowledge about that. But I wonder, Jesse, like, you know, you talk about culture and shifting so that people aren't just spinning in circles. Do you think that there needs to be a cultural shift at Multnomah County?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that of the dynamic between the city and the county and their, I mean, I just see even, I see their dynamic with the city, particularly the mayor's office and the chair's office. But, like, I would say even the way the community is treated, we're consistently iced out at the county. There is no participatory government happening there. There's no desire for feedback loop. There's no, you know, we're really, in Old Town, we're super engaged with City Hall. And we could call anyone to get suggestions in, or, you know, do they want help or feedback on how something's going? And they've always been super into it. Everyone's really clear that they're public servants. And
I mean, that's the good news, right?
Right.
That the city is responsive.
Yeah. And I said this in the governor's task force. I said, you know, I work ground floor retail, front facing all day, every day. And I've been at work every day of the pandemic. And I can tell you the only office that has shown up with any consistency has been Ted Wheeler's office. And I said, and the city's all caught up, and the people that work there have been the most helpful. The county consistently meets us with defensiveness, and I've never seen the state.
And wow. So the state's absent.
Yeah. You know, I think that it leads to sort of uninformed.
And you have a state rep. There is a state rep. Mm-hmm. So that would be Pete. You introduced me to Pete. That would be Pete.
Oh, he's running for the seat.
Grabiel, who's running for Maxine Dexter's seat. Mm-hmm. And that's downtown and northwest.
Yep.
And it never occurred to me. He's been on the show. He was great. It never occurred to me that, of course there is. But it never occurred to me that there would be a state rep for downtown Northwest. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously there is. I guess I just assumed, it's just such a large swath of Portland that, you know, I don't know. They just can't get wrap their arms around. No. It's not very big. It's a little geographic area that's downtown and Northwest. And as Pete pointed out, you know, the people that have the person, and some of his, at least one of his challengers, as far as I know, these are people who don't know what's going on downtown. Mm-hmm. So how could they advocate for downtown or Old Town or frankly, Northwest? I mean, he describes many harrowing situations living there, involving bodies, mm-hmm. really, of people that could be dead or alive. And so with children and his children encountering the same kinds of things that your kids have seen too many times to count. And I just think there's value in somebody who is actually living and working within that district every single day. I mean, it's weird to think that they wouldn't be, but they're not seeing it. And the funny thing is I'm so brainwashed with all this. I'm so brainwashed about how things actually, I would say work or function. Those aren't the words because they don't work. There's no work nor function, but how things are around here, that it wouldn't even occur to me mm-hmm. to find out who the state rep would be for downtown and say, mm-hmm. hey, I work down here and here's what's going on. I wouldn't think about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that a lot of people feel that way. And I think that people are wondering what is happening at the state, right? Like a lot of the stuff is happening at the state right now that's affecting us. Do find out who your state rep is. And you need to like get on the phone and rally neighbors and get your neighborhood association and business association. They are not hearing from enough people. And I think some of what needs to shift is essentially a sort of groundswell or putting leaders on notice that this time of ideology is over, that we need practical solutions to run a government. There's no ideological fix that has succeeded. and so what realistically are we going to do? Like, you know, I consider housing first to be an ideology, right? It is to believe that every single person outside just lost their apartment or just lost their job is completely out of touch. That is not what happened. So everyone's not going to be ready to move right into housing. And the idea that some of the work that we're doing is in the name of harm reduction, I think is a farce. You know, like the Commissioner Jayapal, whose seat I'm running for, when they wanted to hand out foil and straws and everyone went nuts, that she posted on social media, and I think people were pretty, I never comment on anything, but it was a little offensive. She was like, just so you know what harm reduction is. And I commented and I said, don't talk down to us. We all grew up in the 80s. We know what harm reduction is. There's no added harm with clean or dirty foil. In the 80s, there was an added harm with using dirty needles. We get it. But
not using needles.
Right, but to talk down to the public as if like that's where the word harm reduction is coming from, right? From the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah, absolutely.
So like, don't talk down to us. And I see that a lot. I see a lot of leaders that are like out of touch and they talk down to people. And, you know, even watching, like I'm watching these district attorney debates and Mike Schmidt will say, you know, I'm going to protect your abortion rights. And I was like, don't talk down to us.
How?
We all know it's codified in the Constitution. Like, don't, this is a very informed
base. How is the
base.
District attorney who prosecutes crime going to protect our abortion rights? Do we go to the DA for abortions? I'm always so confused by this.
But I think to even believe that the public doesn't know, this is a pretty informed group, right? That the public doesn't know that it's codified in our
Not
Constitution.
Only that, no restrictions. I mean, I'm pro-choice. But also, we are the most extreme. As far as I know, maybe Russia and China might tie us. We are the most extreme place in the world as far as abortion policy goes. I mean, most people think Europe's pretty progressive. They think we're monsters. Those are Catholic countries. They have restrictions. Oregon has none. Not a single restriction. get an abortion. Are you overdue? Is the baby past due? Have at it. You know, we just don't have any restrictions whatsoever on it. And this idea that it's under threat at all times is a rhetorical trick.
I told someone interviewed me. Someone interviewed me the other day about Measure 110, and that the Drug Policy Alliance, their feeling was like, hey, this was really good for people that needed their records expunged. And he said, what do you say to that? And I said, I think that people might forget where we are, right? Like, I have two employees that have felony records, and I just wrote to the DA's office, like our neighborhood DA that we got, and I said, hey, are they eligible for expunging their records? They were. And like within a week, it was resolved. I was like, don't misunderstand. Measure 110 didn't make this happen. This has always been in this area. So just don't misunderstand. Like, it's funny, I go back east and they're like, you're the most liberal person I've ever met. And here they're like, what are you, a Trump supporter? I'm like, I don't know what to do with this here. Because it's, I honestly think it's, to your point earlier of not traveling, it's a bit of like lack of exposure.
It's entirely lack of exposure. Mm-hmm. Because based on everything you and I have just discussed, and the way you distilled it so well, no one in the country, as far as I know, possibly the world, has this kind of commitment to narratives in the face of abject failure. Mm-hmm. and death. Like, a lot of death.
Yeah. I mean, I think I told you last time, anytime people question me about what I'm saying and if it's true, someone said, what do you say to people that don't believe you? I said, I don't care if you believe me. I'll meet you any day, anytime, and we'll stand outside my building for 15 minutes and you see how much you can take. And, you know, it's kudos to the kids that work for me, that it's brutal. And we have to limit how much they work front-facing, because it's really traumatic for them. And so I, you know, it's easy for me to brush those feelings of, you know, people wanting to make claims in the face of failure, that I'm like, it doesn't matter to me what you think. I can show you what is. I think we might be a bit of the epicenter of how policy is going. Like, if you're not sure if it's working or not, just come sit in the lobby. Better yet, sit outside.
Jesse, this is going to seem stupid because your position is nonpartisan, but you know, people don't know that. And I think voters, we have a growing amount of voters that are non-affiliated because of our motor voter law in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And so they aren't affiliated with any party, and I think our voter turnout is relatively low, and it concerns mm-hmm. me. And in this closed primary system we have, I don't like it, and I think it can, in my opinion, it contributes to this low voter turnout. But I just want to make sure everybody knows that these local races, district attorney, the ones that are coming up next month in May, district attorney, county commissioners, city, we'll talk about that later. I don't want to get everybody too overwhelmed because it's going to be really overwhelming, but city too, nonpartisan, mm-hmm. mayor, nonpartisan. Your race, Jesse, is nonpartisan. You don't put down a party affiliation. People's ballots are going to list everybody. Mm-hmm. But just because I know people will ask, because we do live here in this really, unique and, I'd say, strange and was, and I think we can bring it back to, wonderful place. And in general, many things about it are still wonderful. People are going to want to know, are you a Democrat?
So I've been registered independent my entire life, even back east. And part of the reason was I wanted to force myself to read everyone's platform. So I generally, in voting...
That is so you. How can I make this very difficult on myself? Yeah.
generally, in voting, I've always voted along Democratic lines. like if you look at my voting record. But I have never been super comfortable affiliating myself with groups when I feel like I don't get to dictate what the platform is.
No, so. I understand. And then again, nobody goes to Multnomah County for an abortion, and abortion certainly is not a threat in the state, not a threat in any way in the state of Oregon. Again, mm-hmm. no restrictions. Are you pro-choice? Everybody's going to want to know that.
I'm absolutely pro-choice.
What else do we need to know about you that we haven't talked about?
You know, one of the things that I think has been really helpful for people to hear is a little bit of the context of my family backstory, which is short, don't worry.
No, I think it's great.
So my grandfather immigrated here from China in the 30s, and he moved to Baltimore, and he married my grandmother, who they had an interracial marriage before it was legal in America. It was only allowed in Washington, D.C., so this was before the Loving Supreme Court case. So my grandparents were early adopters of interracial marriage.
and that's amazing.
My parents, when I was about six, my father became paralyzed. And about 4 years later, my sister was born with a severe birth defect. This was before the Americans with Disabilities Act, so he lost his job. And there was no disability payment that he would receive. And so we moved into my aunt's basement, and my mom cleaned houses for a living. And they told all of us that we had to become good at something if we wanted to get out, meaning getting out of poverty. So they put us all into different sports. So that's how I ended up in fencing. My brother played soccer. My younger sister didn't get the memo. So
she also had a, is she the one with the birth defect?
She is. Yeah. She ended up being okay, but that she spent the first few years of her life in the hospital. So they just had a lot of medical debt, and my father couldn't work. But, you know, from that, and I traveled a lot for sports. I did it. I traveled all over the world, but I did it as, like, a poor kid in an expensive sport. So there were times, like, I would go to a World Cup, and a cab driver once stole all of my money. So, you know, I would be competing. I would be doing Olympic trials and sometimes not have enough money for food, which is not the best way to qualify for the Olympics.
And not the best way to be an athlete. Yeah. Yes, right. No fuel.
Pro tip. So then I went on to undergraduate school at Penn State University because they were willing to let me start right away. And it would be a lot of stability for me. So, like, some of the first stability I would have ever had.
Like food and a place to live.
Correct.
And, yeah.
That kind of stability, yeah. Yes. So
things we just take for granted.
Mm-hmm. So I ended up studying teaching because I knew what it was like to not understand how to navigate the system, and I wanted to focus on working with high-risk students that maybe were struggling to navigate the system. And when I moved to Portland, I worked at an after-school program at Roosevelt High School. I later went on to be the education coordinator at the Native American Youth and Family Center, and then went back to get my master's in public administration. And I actually just then opened my first business because I think I felt my parents were still living in my aunt's basement. So this is about 20 years later, still living in my aunt's basement, but my mom had gone back to pastry school, and I wanted to open a business. I wasn't sure what kind. Prosper Portland had done an economic development study in the neighborhood I wanted to open that said that the types of businesses that would do well would be a bakery, a flower shop, a bookstore. So I told my mom if she moved out here, I would open a bakery so she could work there. So that's where Posies came from.
And that was your first business?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How old were you?
27.
Right out of grad school?
No. So I wrote my business plan at a job I
for
had.
Posies?
For Posies. Wow. But I was pregnant, and so I had my daughter, and then when she was 18 months old, I used the business plan that I had written then to open this business. So
that's a really incredible story.
Thanks.
That's amazing. And did you know at the time that, like, what, I don't know what the statistic is, it doesn't really matter where you start it, like 50% of businesses, I think, fail, right, in the first year? Or?
I think it's higher. Maybe it's 50% high in the first year, and it's like 80% in the first 3 years. But yeah, Posies is actually still alive. I sold it to my brother-in-law, but I ran it for 12 years. And about halfway through, we opened the hotel, the first hotel, and a couple years later, we opened the second. And then it became too many things to manage. So, but yeah, Posies ended up being super successful. And, you know, it's funny, I went back there recently, and it was opened with the intention of, when I opened, all the coffee shops in Portland were like a little too cool for school. And if you went with kids, they were always kind of glaring at you at the prospect of you ruining their experience in a coffee shop. So I was like, I'm just going to open a coffee shop that's nice to kids and parents. And because I was like, everyone loves you when you're pregnant and they hate you when you have kids. So
that's true.
Anyway, that's what I had been operating. But then I was there recently, and, you know, I don't own it anymore. But this little kid, maybe 3 years old, ran past me and into the playroom. And the mom was like, oh, I'm so sorry. And I said, that's okay. And I said, I have three kids. It's no problem. And she's like, oh, you're probably not getting much of a break then. And I said, I'll tell you a secret. I actually opened this business 15 years ago for mothers like you and kids like your little girl, so that you wouldn't feel uncomfortable being in the world. And she almost started crying, and she was like, you started this? I am so grateful for this place. And so it's nice to go back and, like, see that parents still feel good and welcome there.
And your brother-in-law is still running it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's still in the family, and I think that's amazing. And your mom, was she doing pastries there?
Yeah, so my mom stayed there until I sold it, so she was the baker the whole time. So and then we licensed the recipes to the bakery.
Okay.
So those are all her recipes.
That's amazing. Jesse, anything else? Anything else we should know? I mean, I love that you included that story, because I think that's really important. I think people need to understand, you know, in Portland, we have this very strange distaste for business. And there's this assumption that everyone who runs a business or owns a business or maybe even works for one is not a good person. And I don't think the majority of Portlanders feel that way, but I do think there's a loud narrative along those lines. And I appreciate that story because you built all this yourself. I mean, you came from nothing. Mm-hmm. You're not Donald Trump with $1 million and hey, go build a business. That's not what happened here.
Yeah.
I mean, you were engaged in like a fair amount of food scarcity most of your life.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah. So I do not come from.
But I guess you had nothing to lose. I mean, maybe that's part of it.
I think it is. You know, my husband did not grow up financially in those circumstances and was much more risk averse. And I'm always like, what's the worst that could happen?
Right. So, because he maybe not a lot, but he had something to lose. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure. Is it Joni Mitchell says freedom's just another word for nothing left
right.
to lose.
That's right.
Yeah. So I think it, if you already know what bottom is, it's easier to, you know,
it's not scary anymore because you've been there.
Right. It's not scary. Or, you know, people sometimes, I think, believe that if you run out of money, you die. And I tell people, actually, you can have negative dollars in the bank and you still don't die. You just have to ask for help. So just knowing that everything is navigable, I think, honestly, it makes our political problems much more solvable than I think we might imagine. So
yeah, I think that's right. Thank you so much. But please, is there anything else we left out here?
The only thing I would say...
talk about your district. What's your district?
So my district is District 2. And even though all four commissioners are going to be on the primary this time, you'll only get it... You only get names that are for your district. And mine is actually a special election to seat someone that stepped down. So everyone else is a primary for their district for a four-year term. Mine is a special election that could be seated immediately for 2 years. My district boundaries are I-84 to the south, the Columbia River to the north, St. John's to the west, and Northeast 148th to the east. That is District 2. This election, so ballots will drop May 1st, and they're due May 21st. And this is actually the last year that the county will have primaries. Next year, it will all be November.
So people should vote if they don't want to have to deal with this again when it comes up with city councilors, because here's the deal, you guys. Honestly, there are so many people running for city council. Your ballot in November, if you don't get this county stuff done with, I don't, you know, your vote's your business, but I'm just encouraging everybody to vote so we can be finished with this county stuff. If we're not done with that, then don't you have, Jesse, don't you do a face-off in November?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so then you end up on the November ballot with these city councilors and the mayor. I mean, this ballot's going to be like 500 pages long.
Yeah, so I need to get 50% plus one vote to have this end in May.
Yeah, and I just think for the good of all of us in the citizenry who aren't running, or if you're running, frankly, I mean, just do this for your own peace of mind. Please open that ballot in May and vote for county commissioners and of course vote for the district attorney, but get rid of this idea that some of these commissioners are gonna spill over onto November, because if they do, that's how much longer your ballot's gonna be. And this idea of ballot fatigue, I know it sounded like some sort of scare tactic or something. The more, look around. I mean, the more people running for city council, I think we're all seeing, and this ranked choice system and the single transferable vote, I think we're all sort of seeing how difficult November's going to be. And let's not make it any worse on ourselves. Let's just be done with the county in May. So that would be, that's just, you know, my two cents on that. Please, please open your ballot in May. It really does matter. And as far as Nathan Vasquez and Mike Schmidt go for the DA race, Jesse, they're the only candidates, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that'll be decided in May.
Correct.
And then it's really just a matter of whether the commissioners go on.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And then how do they determine who the... So one question I had is how they determine who the chair is. They don't, because that's already Jessica Vega Peterson, correct?
Mm-hmm. We voted 2 years ago for the chair seat.
Right. So that, it will not come up again for two more years.
Correct.
But it sounds like you think that there are ways around that Multnomah County Byzantine system where the chair just sort of controls everything and everybody only gets to vote on what the chair decides.
Correct.
But it's more helpful if you have other people who are supporting your ideas, is it not?
Yeah, I mean,
if you're the only one, it's difficult.
Yeah, you need three people. I mean, with a majority vote, you can vote down the budget that the chair writes, write your own budget and pass that. With a vote of three, you can have a special meeting, pass a policy, and just codify it at the next meeting. That there are a lot of things you can do once you have a majority of the board.
Are you able to say if there are any candidates that you think will assist with a majority, or are you not at that point yet?
Well, so right now, because mine is a special election, I could theoretically be seated this year. And so Sharon and Julia and myself, I believe, are pretty aligned on everything.
Oh, I think that's right.
So
I think that's right.
The three of us.
You could be seated right away, potentially.
Yes. I would doubt, the chair gets to decide when you're seated, so I doubt that would happen. But it can still happen this year. Well, I think it won't necessarily happen before the budget is passed. I think they'll get the budget passed and then do it. But all the other commissioners won't be seated until January.
Okay. And that's what happened with Julia Brim Edwards. So, mm-hmm. You know, Sharon Myron voted no on the budget. I knew people were going to ask where Julia was on that. Julia was not seated yet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's at the chair's discretion, the timing on that. There is a window where it closes and the chair just has to put her in. But she wasn't there for the budget. I just want to clarify that. Julia Brim Edwards did not have a chance to vote yes or no on the budget. But and you may not either. it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Anything else we should know?
The only other thing I need is I need to raise money. And if people aren't sure what it's for marketing. So all of those brochures you get in the mail.
And the signs. And
the signs, yeah. So it's to help with name recognition. I am going up against someone that has a lot of name recognition.
Yeah.
Not necessarily for all positive reasons, but, you know, that's my...
And you need 150 more people to donate in the next 2 weeks, is my understanding, to be done with that?
Well, so my target fundraising goal is between $150,000 and $200,000. I've already raised about $85,000. If I get 150 people to donate, the maximum I can receive is $568 per person. So
if you're... If you have a household where you're married, both of you could, both individuals or an adult child, say, who lives with you, all those individuals who are adults can donate $568.
Mm-hmm. Children can too, but they have to know that it happened.
I didn't know that. Is that true?
Is my understanding.
Oh, interesting. Yes. Okay.
But that if I have 568.
So let your three-year-old know that $568 of her candy money went to Jesse Burke.
And that it's, and businesses can't donate and PACs can't contribute.
It's got to be an individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's really limited. It's kind of the great equalizer too, though. But
sure.
If I get 150 more of the 568, then I'll be done fundraising. And I'm trying to finish it in the next 2 weeks because you have to spend actually the whole rest of the time just being out there and people.
Yeah, you need
to
meet people, mm-hmm. and you need to be shaking hands, and you need to be out talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do that if you're just on the phone banging out calls asking for money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are two different, very different things.
Yeah. So, anyway, I started with texting people because I don't know how many people actually like talking on the phone anymore, but I said...
Did any of that work?
Mm-hmm, yeah. And I said, I am doing the painful task of having to do outreach because I personally cannot afford to pay for all of these things.
Right.
I can contribute unlimited to my campaign, but I can't really afford to...
Yeah, again, you're not, you don't have a trust fund.
Right.
So it's anyway. All on you.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's the only other thing. But yeah, I tell your friends.
And I just think, I mean, I know there's going to be follow-up questions like, well, what is the money really for? Where does it really go? What about, I mean, look, if she has staff or personnel, they cost money. Do they mm-hmm. not, Jesse? I mean.
Yeah, you can actually read where everyone's money goes on OraStar. So it's, you know, it's lawn signs. It's the people that will do the printing and the mailing. It's a company called Hopkins Sachs that I have a campaign manager. You can see, like, none of it goes to the candidate.
I mean, this isn't like Sarah Palin buying clothing and getting her hair done. That's not, mm-hmm. I mean, we just don't have enough, even if somebody wanted to do that, we just don't have enough money floating around in this city for that kind of luxury. That's just not, I mean, as far as I know, virtually all candidates spend it on the same things. It's people to give them advice, staff to delegate things to, mailers, people to hand out the mailers, people to knock on doors, people to doorbell, and all that stuff. Just printing something costs money.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to log every single one of those.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah,
and thank you for running.
Sure.
And thank you for all the civic involvement that you've been engaged in way before you decided to run. Thank you.
Thanks. I appreciate that.